Session number 26947.
Mr. Jarvis, reel 8. Now, we got to the point in the landing on the 24th of March, where at about 6 o'clock in the evening, 1800 hours, your role changes again. You've had this period of looking after prisoners, and then suddenly you were brought into a more military role. Can you tell us about this?
Yes, we were allocated, the glider pilots were allocated a section of the perimeter that we had to defend in the event of attack by German troops. And we dug slit trenches and made obviously normal military preparations for such an attack.
Now, where were these slit trenches in relationship to everything else? From what you've said, were they facing the river Isel?
Yeah, the river is Isel, that's right.
Sorry.
That's right, doesn't matter. But yes, we were the other side, the east side of the railway track, about 200 yards away from the river Isel. And, obviously we dug them sufficiently deep with a view to the possibility of an attack during the night.
Now, could you... I know you can't describe a slit trench, but what dimensions were you digging? What tools were you using to dig it?
Well, we had trenching tools, which are like small spades. And
You hadn't got a proper picker or shovel?
No, just hand trenching tools.
And how deep and how big?
Well, we tried to at least get about 5 foot deep, maybe about 5 foot, well, 4 or 5 foot wide. It was only for one or two people, which we dug our own slit trenches, actually.
Were you still with Peter?
Peter Geddes, yes, I was.
So he was your oppo with
you? Oh, yes, he was. We stayed together, yeah.
And how wide?
Well, probably about 2 feet, no more than that.
So not much wide, just enough for you to get in?
Absolutely, yes.
And how long did this take?
Probably about an hour and a half. It was quite hard work, to be honest.
Now, did anything happen in the first period? Because it seems to have been fairly quiet till about 11 o'clock.
That's right. No, things were fairly quiet. There were the odd bursts of machine gun fire from the German positions over the other side of the River Isel. But in the main, it was reasonably quiet. We assumed that they were getting themselves ready for a counterattack. And it would probably be swift and quite brutal when they finally did attack us. Yes.
Now, how were you feeling in yourself? I mean, it's all very well to do your job as a glider pilot. Mm. But how were you feeling? Were you nervous about this prospect of actual ground fighting with whatever the Germans threw at you?
Well, naturally, yes, because the thoughts of Arnhem, which was pretty savage, came to mind, and we expected we could possibly encounter those sort of conditions, to be honest.
Now, what happened at 11 o'clock then, at 2300 hours that night?
Well, we'd been allocated times when we were going to be on guard throughout the night. And part of the time you're obviously allowed to sleep. But come 11 o'clock at night, tremendous gunfire opened up. And it was virtually ear-shattering, the noise. And incandescent shells were going over our heads towards the German lines. Obviously, from the Second Army, they were pounding the German positions near a small town called Buchholz. That was a short way away from Hamminkeln, and largely with a view to prevent them bringing up reserves. And it went on and on, quite deafening, but after about 2 hours, suddenly it stopped.
Now, did you know what this was at the time, or have you found out since?
Oh, we have found out it was the Second Army laying down a barrage to protect us. No, we didn't. All we knew, the direction of the shells, and they were going overhead from the direction of the Rhine, so it's obvious it was our people.
Were any dropping short?
No, not at all.
So why did it stop?
Well, I think they decided that they had done whatever damage was necessary to the German reserves.
Now, shortly after, there was a German attack with a Tiger tank on one of the bridges. Can you tell us what you saw of that?
Well, a group of German troops, supported by a German Tiger tank, approached one of the bridges, and a tremendous battle broke out between the airborne troops who were defending that particular bridge. Now, there were considerable losses on either side, And but eventually they were moving forward with such an intensity, it was obvious they were going to overrun the bridge and recapture it, the Germans. So the airborne troops took the decision that they would blow the bridge to prevent it actually by falling into German hands.
Now, what happened next then?
Well, I gather that the troops were, the airborne troops, they had quite grievous losses, and including a number of the troops which I actually took over the Rhine in my glider.
And that was going on in the sort of throughout the night then.
That's right.
For about 1 or 2 o'clock.
That's right. And then after that, it was it quietened down until about dawn, other than duels between Spandau machine guns and Bren guns periodically.
Have you managed to get any sleep during this?
Well, let's say we dozed off, that's about all. It wasn't a deep sleep in the accepted sense of the word, no.
So what happened next?
Well, come around about daylight, early morning, we were expecting at any time a counterattack to take place. But then suddenly we saw a dogfight between a couple of RAF Tempests and a Messerschmitt 262 jet fighter. That's the first jet fighter that was engaged during the war, and that was by the German Air Force. And there was a hell of a battle overhead took place, and the two Tempests eventually shot down the Messerschmitt, and it dived into the line several miles in an easterly direction.
And the rest of the morning there doesn't seem to have been much, and then there's suddenly this big attack.
Yeah, so what about mid-morning roughly, we were suddenly aware that three Tiger tanks had appeared on the east bank of the River Isel, and we realised that they were going to come across probably with an unknown quantity of German soldiers to attack the perimeter. And obviously we were very, very concerned, because with heavy equipment like that, we couldn't possibly deal with it, or the airborne troops couldn't deal with it. But fortunately, a Typhoon squadron was called up by radio, because there was a liaison officer with us for the RAF. And they brought up a Typhoon squadron, and about half a dozen Typhoons dived onto these three tanks with their rockets. And the noise was absolutely deafening, and explosions. And we're talking about 300 yards away from us, thereabouts. And it was absolutely spectacular, and especially to see the Typhoons, you know, going down in a taxi rank type of maneuver, each taking a turn to go down to attack these tanks. And they thoroughly demolished them, and it left them as smoking and burning wrecks. And we never saw or heard anything more of those tanks afterwards. And the anticipated counterattack never materialised.
So, how about your defensive role? How long did you stay in position?
Well, we stayed there again for the rest of the day and that night.
So all the 25th.
That's right.
And through the night of the 25th
into
the
26th. That's right. And then during the day, the glider pilots were pulled out from the line, their perimeter, and we were engaged in the middle of the area that had been taken. And we then dug further slit trenches for our protection, and were told to wait there. We had no further part to play in the battle. And during the night of Sunday, the 25th, we were attacked two or three times by Junkers 88.
Those attacks.
Yeah, some Junkers 88s came over the airborne area, and that they sprayed it with machine gun fire quite intensively. But luckily, being in slit trenches, we didn't come to any particular harm.
So, what next?
Well, then we stayed there for a little while, for a day or so in that area, until the Second Army had made contact with the perimeter and joined up with the airborne troops. And more of the infantry and Second Army came into the area and were relieving us of what responsibility we had at all. And we were just in waiting to be relieved. That's the glider pilots. Now, come the day when we were marched behind the lines and then conveyed by lorry back to the River Rhine, and we went across by a lorry on bridges that I think were Bailey bridges that had been erected, and went over to the west side of the Rhine on our way home. On our way home. And we came to, first of all, to a Dutch town called Zanten. That was just a few miles west of the Rhine. Stayed there for a while, had some refreshment, and then stayed overnight in the town. And then the following day moved on to a Dutch town called Helmond. Again, we stayed there for some while, and then we were conveyed back to Eindhoven Airport, where we're due to be transported back to Dunampany, which is our home base near Swindon.
Now, did you celebrate at all, or were you able to celebrate at all once you got behind the line and at these towns and on the
Well,
way
not
back?
really, because there wasn't much to celebrate with. We were under battle conditions. Obviously, we're filthy, tired, and we had nothing that we could actually celebrate with. But obviously, we were mighty relieved that we had survived, those of us that did.
Now, what did you do when you got back to your airfield then?
Well, I got back to Eindhoven, and then we were then put in Dakota aircraft to be flown back to Dunampany, and we weren't actually put in any order. They just put a number of glider pilots in the Dakota, and then took off and took us home. But there was an incredible coincidence, because I was sitting in the pilot with a crowd of other in the fuselage with a crowd of other pilots, when suddenly one of the crew members came down and said, "Does anyone know what happened to Stan Jarvis and Peter Geddes?" Asked one of the glider pilots, and he said, "Well, I don't know what happened to him, but," he said, "all I can tell you is sitting down there." So this fellow came down and said to me, "You Stan Jarvis and Peter Geddes?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, we towed you over." And it was an actual Alex Blythe, very Dakota, that we were brought home. And I thought, that's an immense coincidence. He rushed back to the cabin, told Alex that we were there in his very aircraft, and all the crew came down, and there was quite a celebration, the fact that they were so pleased that we had survived.
And when you landed, were you still retained with the glider regiment, or were you then posted to an RAF unit? Because, I mean,
Now,
you'd done the job you'd joined the glider regiment to do. What happened?
well, what happened here, we arrived back in this country at Dunampany, and there's again a little amusing incident, because it's one of the RAF bases where customs and excise controlled arrivals and departures to the continent. And when we left the aircraft and we put in 3-ton Bedford trucks, suddenly the customs arrived and wanted to know if we had anything to declare. Well, you can imagine the reaction from the soldiers in the filthy condition, hadn't been in battle condition for several days. They didn't take too kindly to the customs officers. So some of the army pilots were what you might safely describe as rough diamonds. They immediately put magazines on their rifles, jumped down, and told the customs officers to go away in very colourful language. And apparently the officer said to the customs officer, "I can't be held responsible for these men, circumcised, returned from." And diplomatically, the customs officer then departed, and they weren't seen again.
So what happened then?
We were then taken to our glider pilot areas, where our dormitories were, etc., and our headquarters. And then debriefing took place quite extensively over several hours in Dan Ampney. Any weapons, equipment, and including German weapons, by the way, that actually had been confiscated, they were then removed taken from us, and we were then allowed, obviously, to have showers and cleaned ourselves up, had change of uniforms, and then carried on with our normal squadron duties. We were sent on a fortnight survivor's leave immediately. Those who had actually obviously survived. And when we came back...
Now, what was the survivor's leave like?
It was a fortnight. We had a fortnight.
What was it like, though? I mean, how did you feel on it? Did you have any reaction to what you'd been through?
Well, I don't remember very much other than pleased for having a fortnight's leave. But, of course, our families were highly relieved because they realised what we'd been involved in. And it was a very pleasant leave as far as I remember, yeah.
Now, did you then go back to Down Empty?
Yes, went back to Down Empty, and then we stayed there for a few weeks. And... then, eventually...
Were you doing anything?
Just doing a little bit more training with gliders. We were really passing the time until it was decided that we would go back to the RAF. And then we did got allocated back to the RAF and then carried on with our normal career.
So when was that?
Let me see. It must have been round about April. Just about towards the end of the war, April, May time. Again, that this is dim in my memory.
So where were you posted to then? Which RAF unit were you sent to?
Well, we were then sent back to RAF units, and we were posted to various stations, actually. And
you don't remember this period too well.
You may
notice we've suddenly gone from very specific to very... vague.
Absolutely.
And this is because it's vague for you, isn't
Absolutely it? Vague for me. It is indeed, yeah. And I was at a couple of RAF stations, as I remember. I think Leicester East was one of them. And then we were told that we were going to continue with our RAF careers. For myself, I was going to be sent to an OTU, Operational Training Unit, up near Dundee, with a view to converting onto Typhoons and then resuming my career with a view to being posted to the Far East. And I understood I was going to join 174 Squadron afterwards.
Now, what happened about your Typhoon training, your officers' training, and you know?
Well, in actual fact, whilst I had the posting arranged to go to OTU in Dundee, unfortunately, it coincided with about the 10th, 11th of August, and a couple of days afterwards, the atomic bomb was dropped. It virtually finished the war, and my posting, not only to the OTU, but also to the squadron and onward to the Far East, was cancelled, in line with many others. And that virtually completed any serious flying I undertook. Until the day I was demobilised from the RAF.
So what were you doing, roughly? I know you don't remember the place, but, I mean, just give us an idea of the sort of jobs you were on. I mean,
well,
you weren't flying.
Yes, I flew Masters. I flew Masters, which are very, very similar to Harvard's. And I also took minor courses on Tiger Moths.
Now, hang on, what were you flying the Masters for? Was this actually with a purpose, or just...
No, just general flying as service pilot, yes. Doing whatever is required, transporting from A to B, conveying passengers, that sort of thing. It wasn't very serious flying because the war was over, and obviously there were thousands of other air crew who are now redundant, and the RAF didn't know what to do with them.
And anything else about this time? What were you, you know...
No, there's very little. I think it
Just a matter of routine.
that was routine until eventually I was demobilised. That was in April 1947.
Now, what do you remember about your demobilisation? I mean, how did we talked a lot about how they took you in. How did they get rid of you, or what was the process?
Well, I was posted to an RAF dispersal unit near Blackpool, and there it was very swiftly was given demobilisation clothes. My RAF uniform was withdrawn. Anything associated with my RAF equipment was taken away, and then were very gently released with adequate ration cards and money, and then released to go home.
What
It
did you
was as
think of
simple as
your,
that.
what did you think of your demob suit? I mean, was it
Dreadful.
what was but some people say that. What was dreadful about it?
Well, I think it had been made by some obscure tailor in the north of England, and it looked as though it would be more suitable on a hair coursing area more than probably in a city or a business situation. Yeah, it was fairly coarse and not very nice. Yeah.
And did you ever wear it?
Oh yes, I did wear it because remember, I just completed 4 years' service in the RAF, and I didn't even possess a suit.
Now, when you came out, what were you going to do? I mean,
Well, I came out of the RAF with no idea whatsoever. I certainly had no intention of going back into the engineering or the foundry work. But very fortunately, my father, who worked for the Port of London Authority for 40 years, he had, I think, a certain pride in the fact that I was a pilot, and he was all were talked to the PLA management about my position, and they said they would like to see me with a view to offering me a position in the PLA. So during one leave, shortly before I was to mobilise, I went to see the docks manager of the London St Catherine Docks, who had a chat with him for about half an hour, and he said to me, "You're obviously a very suitable person to be employed by the PLA, and when you're discharged, will you please contact me and I will make the necessary arrangements."
And that was May 47 you got a job there.
Yeah, May 47,
And
that's
what
right.
was your job? That was a St Catherine's dock then.
No,
Okay.
I'd interview at St Catherine's Dock. No, I informed the PLA I had been demobilised, and then I was informed to report to the docks manager of the Royal Group of Docks on a given day. And the position I was appointed to was a temporary, unestablished clerk, which you couldn't get much lower. Anyway, that was it. I joined there as a temporary clerk, but fairly rapidly I managed to progress through the system, and I've got various promotions.
Can you tell us about your work? We're quite interested in the dock because obviously the docks are very important to the maritime and, well, even the military strength of a country. If
Yeah.
you could tell us what your work was, firstly, at each stage as you went through. We'll come back to the RAF Volunteer Reserve at the end,
Oh
but
yes,
here.
yeah. No, the type of work was pure, simply clerical work in the docks, recording the reception and dispatch of cargo, where the accountants are dealing with wages, a mundane type of clerical work. It wasn't of any great importance, but obviously I could see that it had great potential with regard to progression, because it is a vast organisation, and so that therefore I decided I'll work hard with a view to making a career in the PLA.
And tell me the stages of your career and the levels of responsibility you achieved bit by bit.
Well, first of all, within 18 months, I was able to take a competitive educational examination to be appointed from the wages staff to the salaried staff. And I was fortunate that I was one of four out of 36 who reached the required level. And therefore, I was placed on the salaried staff, and that was in February 1949.
And What did that change the work you were doing at the time? Or was...
Oh, yes. I then moved away from general clerical work and I went to the PLA headquarters in Trinity Square and then received about 6 months training through various departments to fit me for further promotion.
And what were these stages? Tell us, you know, take us
through. Well, more intensive accountancy work, ledger work, difficult to say much beyond that, on general administration.
And when did you get your next promotion then?
Well, I then was sent to the India Millwall docks and became what we call a station clerk. That is on an operational department. I'm now moving to the operational side of discharging and loading vessels, more than simple clerical as I had previously. And that was allocated to South West India Dock, whereby my job was to ensure that the administrative side of the department was run on behalf of what was known as a senior traffic officer. He was the head of department. And I would then receive training, and then eventually I was given the opportunity to be undertake temporary work as a traffic officer. Now, traffic officer was the first line of management in the PLA from the salaried staff. But I was acting a traffic officer again until...
What did the traffic officer do?
He was responsible for the management of discharging and loading vessels and of the dock labour and staff. Related to a certain part of the dock department. Each one had a section to look after, and they in turn was responsible to the senior traffic officer. That was the administrative layout.
And your next step?
Well, in the early part of 1943...
73. You said 43.
I had 43. 53. It was 1953.
Oh, right. Sorry.
That's right, yeah. The early part of 1953, I then applied for and was interviewed and was appointed to be a traffic officer. And to say that it was the first rung of the management grade in the PLA. And then I carried on doing that work for some years, actually. It was something to the order of about 12 years. Very intensive work, dealing with dock labour, discharging and loading vessels, negotiating with trade unions, shipping companies. It was intensive to the extent that people regarded it as being ulcerous work, because an awful lot of people couldn't cope with it. Temperamentally, some people had heart attacks, sometimes had nervous breakdown. Dealing with dock labour is not the easiest thing in the world, as you might imagine.
Well, I think we'll come on to some of these general points when we get to that. So what was your next promotion?
Oh, well then, after about 12 years, I then was applied for and became a traffic officer class 1, and I was posted then to the London St Catherine docks. But I was only there for about a year, and then suddenly I was promoted to a senior traffic officer at the head of department. And I became the senior traffic officer of the Royal Victoria and Bulk Grain Department. I stayed there for a couple of years, and then I was then sent to head office to get more intensive head office experience with regard to further promotion. And again, I was only there for about 9 months, and then I was sent back to the Indian Millwall docks as a personnel manager, again dealing with dock labour and staff and associated problems, but it wasn't an operational job dealing with ships, which obviously was what I was more used to. But then I was transferred in the same capacity to the Royal Group of Docks as a personnel manager, and I stayed there for about a year or two. And then in the latter part of 1972, I was sent back to the Indian Millwall Dock in the capacity as a senior operational manager. And then I while I was there, about a year later, I was appointed as the docks manager of the West India Millwall Dock.